Blog Talk Radio.
And good evening. Welcome to another edition of the New Africa Business Association Blog Talk Radio. I am your host, Bilal Masterdeek Bynums, speaking to you live from Washington, D.C. And we'd like to welcome you to tonight's show. And again, welcome to tonight's show. I'm trying to see where my co-host is at. I don't see him so far, but we will get started here. I hate to get started without him. But look like we just may have to go ahead and just do just that. I don't see where he's called in. And that's unfortunately, I really hate to go without my buddy. But anyway, welcome to tonight's show, to New Africa Blog Talk Radio and I am going to see if I have my other director on with me. Sister Ali, are you with me?
Yes, sir. I am
okay,
here.
All right.
Good evening,
everyone.
I'm going
to Brother
Bilal. How you doing?
You and I are going to be holding it down until Brother Aziz come on. So I am going to give the callers, I would say give the callers a chance to come on, but my goodness, look like we're just about almost at our capacity before we even get through introductions. So I'll tell you, our radio show is really growing, and I hope that we can continue this with the growth. But at the same time, brothers and sisters, it's a new year for the last 8 years, and this is our eighth year of coming on the radio. And so far, we've been trying to, of course, network with each other and try to find African-American communities. So once we find these communities or businesses, we can start doing business with each other. Because again, I was just I just had my accountant give me some statistics on consumer spending, and again, as at the end of 2021 and 22, it was $1.6 trillion. It's projected that this year, 2023 until December, fiscal end of the year of December of this year, 2024, it is projected that African Americans will spend $1.8 trillion.
Wow.
In consumer spending. So again,
wow,
the power of our dollar is the title of this show. And to see, this is what I mean about we as African Americans, we are a country. When it comes
yes,
to we are a country. A country
yes, we
in
are.
Itself. And realizing that we need to start asserting our financial powers, because there's no African nation or no other nation, Arabs or what have you, is bringing in the amount of money that African Americans have that they bring in. Our monies just do not circulate into our communities. It goes into our communities, and like your mother, Sister Aisha, looked at the statistics, and that money's our money stay into our communities once we receive it, paychecks or whatever way, business or what have you. But once we receive our incomes or our monies, it stays into our communities for 4 hours. 4 hours.
Mm.
And then it's gone to somewhere else, and we know where it's going. To the of Caucasians, not only in this country, but all over the world. They just think,
and it stays in their community much longer than 4 hours.
Oh, my goodness. As far as the Caucasian community, it's been staying in there for hundreds of years and continuing to stay. But I am just saying that is the power of the African American dollar. So that is our topic this evening. Of course, we don't have a guest speaker, so it's going to be an open mic.
No, we do. We do. We do have a guest speaker. Remember, we have Ambassador Shamsuddin on today.
I understand we have Ambassador Shamsuddin, and we also have a couple more of those who would like to be guest speakers. But because we couldn't get them in on the proper time, we're going to take and allow them a good introduction times, because we do want to hear from them. But we're hoping that they can set up appointments as to where they can have the show in its entirety or as for as long as they would want to, once they are put in at the proper time as guest speakers. We just got them a little late, but knowing the importance of what they have to say, we're going to certainly get them in to inform us of the important information that I know that they have. So, and I am going to be turning it over to you, Sister Ali, in just a few moments as to where you can do the introductions and bring him on. But I do want to take this time, because New Africa Black Belt Wall Street, we need your memberships. Brothers and sisters, go to the New Africa Business Association website, newafricabusinessassociation.com/DC, because there are many New Africa Business Associations. So in order to get to us, you have to New Africa Business Association .com and put in DC. And of course, at that point, you will be in our website, and we ask you to go to our membership and please become a member, because we need your memberships. And the only way we can continue to stay on the radio, not only stay, but we want to grow much bigger on this radio. But we need to be able to pay our costs. So we need your memberships. If you find us to be a valuable, informative source of information, network marketing and business identification, that's what we're all about. We want to identify African-American businesses in our communities, and that's our emphasis, is the African-American. But brothers and sisters, I say this to any Caucasian friends of ours that are out there listed, we also welcome you. But as you, even as a Caucasian, realize how we have been so badly treated in this country, until when we can do something for ourselves, we owe it to ourselves to start doing it. And so in this case, we don't have channels of communications like, again, the Caucasians do. They have the ABC and the CBS, all the network stations they control. But we have, so they tell our stories, and we're never able to tell our own stories. So again, that must change, and we're going to change it. We're starting off with what we have, but we look forward to growing. So please, we need your memberships. So with that said, I am going to now, Sister Ali, I am going to open up all of our mics for you, and then I am going to let you bring on your first speaker, and after that, we were going to also bring on Mr. Pruitt from out of California. We want to he didn't finish everything we want to hear from him, so I'm going to bring him back, but we look forward to, again, having all of, and even if you have something that you like to address on this radio station, again, send us an email, nabassc@gmail.com. I repeat, nabassc@gmail.com. As a matter of fact, if we do not have your email, you're not getting our programs on a weekly basis. So in order for us to put you on our listening program, we need your email. So if you do no more than just send us your email, so we can put you on the email list, and now you can start getting all the information that we have to give. That is nabassc@gmail.com, and we welcome your emails. So again, Sister Ali, you can go right ahead. I'm opening up all the channels, and they'll be able to hear you just like you can hear them.
Sounds great. Thank you so much, brother. And I definitely concur with the need for membership and for participation. And we as a people, we could really do great, great things when we come together. I am excited today to bring on this guest because not only does he epitomize infrastructure within the Black community of putting together what is needed for the power of the Black dollar to remain within the community, but he also does this domestically and internationally. And I'm talking about Ambassador Waleed Shamsuddin. He is the president and CEO of Supreme Foods Worldwide, a family-owned franchise company with 15 franchise locations within the United States and in Mexico. For over 20 years, his personal consultancy company, Shamsuddin & Associates, has served consultants for athletes, entertainers, entrepreneurs, producers by managing and protecting their personal business and philanthropic interest. Brother Waleed Shamsuddin's vision is to use entrepreneurship to bridge the gap between African Americans in the diaspora and those on the continent, while simultaneously increasing the number of Black-owned entrepreneurs throughout the United States and the world. And by doing so, in December of 2021, the president of Sierra Leone, His Excellency Julius Maada Bio, appointed him as special envoy for the Republic of Sierra Leone as ambassador to Sierra Leone. And his mandate is to promote trade and investment. He also, Ambassador Shamsuddin also runs a nonprofit that's mission to engage, empower, and encourage communities. He is an author of Excellence at Minimum, The Plight of an Entrepreneur. He's a father. He's a husband. He and his life partner and partner in success, Dr. Kiana Shamsuddin, has continued to facilitate these amazing ventures. And so I am very, very proud to bring on Ambassador Waleed Shamsuddin. How are you doing, brother?
Sister Fajda, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm doing fantastic. You know, I appreciate the opportunity to share this evening, and I'm excited to be on the program.
Thank you. Thank you. Another point I want to add to your bio, you are a very proud alumni of the HBCU, Florida A&M University. So I definitely want to put that out there. It's very important. It's very important.
I'm a FAMU Rattler and March in the 100 and KK5 as well. So I did my time up on the highest of Seven Hills. I'm excited and proud.
Oh, my goodness. There you go. There you go. Representing the best way to do it. Yes, yes. Yes, yes. Ambassador, thank you for joining. You know, the topic today is the power of the Black dollar within the community. And before your appointment, you were doing that. With your franchise, how has that been for you over the years, as far as building your business and keeping it within the community and being part of that process?
Well, first I have to say I'm a second generation entrepreneur, and I mm-hmm. came up under the leadership of my father, Lawrence Shamsuddin, who was the founder of Supreme Fish Delight in 1980. And we were birthed out of the Nation of Islam that had the mm-hmm. principles of do for self. So when you look at Malcolm X and you look at Elijah Muhammad and you look at Minister Farrakhan, you know, all of that knowledge and wisdom and understanding of Islam taught us to get into business, to build institutions, to support the community, and to develop something that you could pass down through generations. It's about legacy. So for the past 40 years, you know, in business, I've learned about the struggle, the plight, the challenges, the successes. And if it takes a lifetime, of entrepreneurship to build something, for generations to come, they will thank you for it. You know, that's what it's about. Mm-hmm. The grandbaby saying, thanks, Grandpa, for starting this and for creating something where I can work for my own, build for my own, create for my own, employ my own, and be a contributor to humanity and a contributor to society. So it's not all gravy, but it's something that's needed in our community to really build and support and thrive in.
Awesome. Yeah, most certainly, most certainly. You said it's something that's needed in the community, and that is something that we really want to hold on, hone into as we have this discussion tonight. Can you tell us in more depth why it's needed so much in our community?
I heard in the introduction about the dollar, you know, leaving our hands within 4 hours. And mm-hmm. in economics, that's called the circular flow. And it's very simple. If you bank black, buy black, support black, encourage and invest in black, that dollar begins to circulate more. And in layman's terms, it's like having a piece of the pie. The more people mm-hmm. that support what we're doing, the larger the pie gets, and the more we can eat off of it. And other ethnicities, they understand that. They create jobs and opportunities. They employ, they produce, they manufacture, they bank, and everybody in their community begins to eat. And I learned this at a young age. 20 years ago, I started my nonprofit, and I said, you want to find out who supports you and supports your community, go ask them for some money. Right. You know, when you have a nonprofit, you're writing grants, you're raising capital, and you'll be surprised how other people think of our community. But it's the black businesses in our community that's going to support our black nonprofits. It's the black businesses in our community that's going to give scholarships, that's going to create jobs and opportunity. So it's of paramount that as a people, we seek out those of us who are in business and support them. We seek out those of us who own banks, you know, and bank with them. We seek out those of us who have minority-owned nonprofits, black-owned nonprofits, right, and donate to them, because that's how we keep that dollar flowing. That's how we build legacy and opportunities for our community. Without that, you know, we'll consistently be supporting others in their trust funds, in their college tuitions, right, in their second homes and art collections. It's bigger than just a 9-to-5.
Most certainly, most certainly. So as we work with this idea domestically as a people here, then we are now being introduced into the idea of we can have the same mentality and the same action internationally. Please go into detail and explain the purpose of your role as envoy of trade in Sierra Leone. And how that that connection happens with here in the United States and the black community.
Far too often we look at maybe academia, right? We strive to be masters in this or get a doctorate, and I think that's needed. Academia is needed. We often look at politics, how we can run for city council or Congress, and that's needed as well. But when we think of the final frontier for African Americans is how do we create sustainable businesses that can grow into multinational corporations? How many black-owned businesses are publicly traded? How many black-owned businesses do $1 billion or hundreds of millions of dollars a year in revenue? Right? When we become producers in the global economy, it's another level of respect for us as entrepreneurs or business people or people in general, as a people in general, because we're contributing to the GDP, we're employing thousands of people, we're opening up offices around the world, we're participating in the G20 or the economic forums or the entrepreneurial conferences. This is the final frontier for our people. We've mastered getting elected to office, right? We've held the highest office in the land as the president. We've mastered academia. How many of us have advanced degrees and doctorates and are teaching on very high and strategic levels? But when we get to entrepreneurship, and Sajid, I know this is a passion for you, how many mm-hmm. of us have businesses and offices in multiple regions throughout the world or making money in pesos and dollars and dirham and leons, right? This is
right,
what
right.
serving in that capacity means. And business is just another way of serving. You have the responsibility of your employees and their children and their family when they're employed by you. So when you think about becoming a servant globally in the capacity of an ambassador or a special envoy, it's what can I do to support the world? What can I do to support another country? How can I be of service to create jobs, opportunities, knowledge transfer, innovation, entrepreneurship on the continent of Africa? So mm-hmm. my service over the past, 30-plus years has led me to a position to want to serve by building bridges between those of us in the diaspora and those of us on the continent. And through that is how the door of special envoy and the door of ambassador opened up to me. I was blessed to trace my DNA through African ancestry, both my wife and I. And we did the DNA, and it traced back to Sierra Leone. This was just about a year ago. And I immediately, reached out and said, hey, I'm interested, in providing as much as I can in support of your country. And through letters of expression and through going over and meeting with the Minister of Foreign Affairs and other ministers in country, I shared what I felt I could bring to Sierra Leone. And through that vetting process, I was appointed as a special envoy and also an ambassador to trading investment. And honestly, it's humbling, Saj, to be taken away as a slave, right?
Mm.
To trace my DNA back to the continent and mm-hmm. to return as an ambassador. How profound is that?
Mm. How profound is that? How profound is that? And I'm so glad you
wonderful,
made that point.
Wonderful, because, wonderful.
And I'm so glad you yeah. made that point, because we have to be reminded, we have to remind each other of where we came from and where we are right now as a people, and now the opportunity that we have to go back, but at a higher level than how we arrived here. And I thank you for mentioning you tracing back your ancestry. My mother's ancestry, my ancestry were of the Gullah people in South Carolina, the Gullah Geechee Nation.
Yeah.
And they are direct wow. descendants of Sierra Leone. So
that's right. That's
you
right.
know, in every sense of the word. So definitely keeping that. And my great grandfather was an entrepreneur. He was a mason, and he came up from South Carolina to North Carolina and literally built up cities in Western North Carolina, and he would bring in other contractors to do the same. But the city was built up under his mastery. And so we have that legacy within this country that we received from our ancestors back home. So that leads me to go in more into what you do. Discuss your experience in Africa so far, and how business is being presented, coming as an African-American, coming back and being a delegate, being assigned a delegation position, and then trying to recruit Black businesses in. Explain that, if you can.
So Saj, at first, I was blessed to travel at a very young age. My first trip abroad, I was a junior going into my senior year in high school. And mm-hmm. my mother and father gave me a choice. Hey, you can take this senior trip, right? I think it was to Washington, D.C. or something, or you can make Hajj and go over to Saudi Arabia through Morocco. And that was so mm-hmm. fascinating to me to talk about getting a passport and traveling to a different country. And that just sparked an interest. So I was able to, one, make Hajj, which fulfilled one of the five pillars of Islam, but then also that sparked an interest of international travel. And since, I've been to over 50 countries, around the world.
Wow.
So when,
wow.
when you say doing business on the continent or exploring cultural exchange or looking at ways to do tourism or knowledge transfer, it's first gracing yourself on the continent and being greeted with the words, welcome home. Where have you been? Why? What has taken you so long, brother? Put your American passport up. You're African, right? It's like you walk into a country where everyone looks yeah. like you. That the airlines is black, the pilots are black, the stewards are black, the commercials are black, the billboards are black, the TV is black, right? All of a sudden, you realize how disconnected we've been in America by being part of the minority, as opposed to being fully engaged and connected on the continent where everybody everywhere looks just like you, right? Then, if you're in a Muslim country, it's even that much more connectivity because you're connected by the greetings of peace, as-salam or alaykum, right? So you go into Senegal or Morocco or other Turkey, other countries that are all Muslim, you hear the Adhan being called five times a day. All the names are Arabic, right? The people, the culture is so many similarities that you are like, wow, it's like breath of fresh air, as opposed to growing up in America where we could barely practice our religion, or you're getting picked on for your name or the color of your skin or because of your hair or because you look different. You know, that level of the not just the slavery or the segregation or the Jim Crow, but just being different is not on you. And that's something as a people we have to do. We got to stop running to Europe for a vacation, right? Mm-hmm. Or the Middle East.
Yes,
you know,
please.
We have to go home,
say that again.
And see what it feels like to be on the continent in Africa, in a country with people who look and feel and are sensitive to the ethnic similarities that we have growing up, just that connection, right? And that is the beginning of doing business. Just being on the continent and showing up. I, the first time I went to Dubai was on a buddy pass, right? We know what buddy passes are. You fly free, you get the hookup, you know, you pay the tax, and you save $1,000 because you're flying for free. The second time I was guest of the ruler, I just showed up. Mm-hmm. You know, being African-American in the Middle East is like, wow, who is this brother trackside at a horse racing World Cup, right? That's just something I've never even been to the Kentucky Derby, and I'm sitting trackside in Dubai watching a horse race. Same period. I saw on Facebook, it was like this billionaire had put up $100 million to create entrepreneurs throughout the continent, all 54 countries. He wanted to create entrepreneurs. And you know, I didn't believe it. I called his office and like, hey, is this real? They sent me an invitation. Hey, I grabbed the buddy pass. I was in Lagos, Nigeria. Welcome home, brother. You understand what I'm saying? On the continent. Jumped in a taxi, hit a moped, and next thing you know, I'm sitting with Tony Alumalu, guy worth $2 billion, with a room full of African entrepreneurs talking about changing the world through entrepreneurship. As a people, we have to show up when our conscience is calling us and we're getting these invitations or we see something and our soul is saying, go, 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 go. You go. You show up and show out and look at what the opportunities will come. So from Nigeria, I was there for 2 days. I landed an investor that put $100,000 into my company and to support some of the things that I was doing. Now, imagine if I hadn't gone or didn't get on that buddy pass or didn't meet these people.
Wow.
Because
And just side note, what we have to do as Black Americans, you know, to get $15,000 to put into a business here, right? To get $10,000.
Yes.
And you took a buddy pass across the ocean and $100,000 was given to you.
Yep.
That's amazing.
Sasha,
we have
a unique experience. No other people in the world, 400 years of slavery. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And survive, right? And segregation and survived and Jim Crow and survived. Kids and sons being shot in the streets and survived and are still being educated by the same people who have, you know, suppressed us or enslaved us or being medicated by those who have oppressed us, and yet we still survive. So the world wants to hear our story and not told by someone else. When you show up, they are intrigued. Tell us about this. Tell us about that. Oh, you're Muslim in America? What is your experience like? Oh, my God. How is it, you know? And that level of intrigue wants them to get to know you. And people do business with people that they know. That's what networking is all about, getting to know somebody so that you can trade and do commerce and get to know and understand and do business together. That's the highest level of a relationship. That's like marriage. When you start signing joint venture agreements, you're getting married with somebody. When you start creating MOUs, you're getting married with somebody. So in order to do business with people, you got to get to know them. And to get to know them, you got to show up. And that's what I'm promoting now. Trade delegations, academic delegations, cultural exchange delegations, tourist delegations, to bring our people to the continent for the purpose of doing business.
Awesome. Awesome. And that goes into my next, and that goes into my next point. If you can, and I'm going to open it up, because what you're saying is so inspiring. I know people are humming right now for some Q&As. So how the Black American dollar, explain how the Black American dollar can positively impact Africa, and why African governments, not just Sierra Leone, but why other African governments right now are asking for Black-owned businesses.
So from my experience, the West is known for innovation. The West, I'm saying the Americas. You know, the internet is birthed out of America. American franchises, American culture, music, hip hop, pop, the entertainment, sports, everything that is exciting. Black swag, right? You go any place in the world, you're gonna hear some hip hop. They're gonna be walking with their pants hanging down. They're gonna be emulating Black America. And so that innovation that comes out of America, the what they call the American dream, the world would die for. The white picket fence, the 2.5 kids, right? This is the image that America pushes out through the media throughout the world that has people dying to come to the States, right? So the Black dollar coupled with innovation is what's needed on the continent, right? Because we don't, as African-Americans, don't aspire to be part of the ministry. And in African nations, everybody wants to be a minister of this, a ministry of that, or be part of government, because that's where job security comes in. Aside from corruption, if you want to be able to afford a house or a car, have quality education, you're going to be in a government position. It's not promoting entrepreneurship and innovation. In America, in order for us to survive, it's that 9-to-5 and that hustle. And what's that hustle? Entrepreneurial spirit. So by nature, over the last 700, we've been hustlers, right? Trying to survive and being innovative. And how do we survive with nothing? If we take that innovation and that entrepreneurial spirit with the Black dollar to the continent, like Akon said, you'll make more money in 2 years than you've done in 20 in America.
Wow. Wow. Say that again for the people in the back, please. Say that statement again for the people in the back.
You will make more money in 2 years on the continent than you will in 20 in America.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Right now we are listening to Ambassador Waleed Shamsuddin. He is the special envoy to Sierra Leone for trade and investment. I'm opening up right now. Brother Bly, we're opening up right now for Q&A. Please, everyone on the line, ask your questions.
I got to come in, Sister. I got to come in, Sister Ali. I know.
Go right ahead.
I know there's others. That's why I spoke right on up, because I must come in. First of all, Assalamu alaikum, Ambassador Sampson.
Wa alaikum assalam. Well, I like my
flower.
Yes, sir.
And Ambassador Sampson, it ain't like we didn't know you as a child. And I know my co-hosts say wait to come on and talk about the same thing, because we know you as a child. In other words, we know your dad.
Yeah, right.
We knew your dad. And so your introduction and seeing where you came from, we're quite proud, because in 1995 is when I met your father. And in 1995, that's when the imam bought on the New Africa Business Association. And at that time, he called it the Muslims Business Association. But because of not so much feedback from other folks around the world, until he changed the name from the Muslims Business Association, American Muslims Business, to New Africa Business Association. This was in 1995. And at that time, New Africa Business Associations Incorporated just about all over the country. And your Atlanta, Georgia was our national headquarters at that time. And and I was the vice president here in Washington, D.C., And later on, I was voted in as president. And I've been at the helm of New Africa Business Association, just like your dad and all the others down in Atlanta. And I'm glad to see the young generation, how you guys are exceeding us. And I'm glad to see that because we did a wonderful job. But so, again, I congratulate you, and I'm so glad to see you and others, our young generation, of caring on the way that you do, because, like, as you know and I know, African-Americans and our dollar, we made this country rich. We made this country rich.
That's right.
When we first got here, and at that time it was called just the black soil before it was called the United States. And, of course, that black soil was where they put all African-Americans out in the fields, and those fields ranged all the way from Texas all the way to Virginia, to include Delaware and Maryland, because that's where all the concentration of slave owners. And we made this country rich then, and we're still making this country rich. So again, as we, and I'm so glad that we have experience, because brothers and sisters, like the ambassador is saying, and we just sort of talked about last week, and we're going to bring in another brother in a few moments, but just like we just talked about last week, if we was to put together a delegation, and Brother Ambassador, this is something you can speak on if you like, but we're contemplating putting together a delegation, and we want to go to Africa. But when we go over there, we want to have at least 200 committed business folks who are committing to have at least $10,000 to put towards growing a business somewhere in Africa. So again, you figure a delegation of 200 of us, and each one of us coming with $10,000, and of course, I would love to have a resort, a brand new resort where our own hotels, our own homes, or what have you, our own lands. But I know that that's easily done. That would be easily done by African Americans because how poor our dollar bills go in any parts of Africa. So again, I don't really have a comment. I had that statement. And if you like to reply to it, you may, and then that the mics are open.
So first of all, thank you for that. And I think you're absolutely right. If we can harness the collective energy of business persons in the diaspora with not only their acumen, their intelligence, but also their money, we can change the world on the continent. And we're not talking about tapping into Bank of America or Wells Fargo. There are banks that are funded through Islamic Sharia compliant resources that will support our investment, whether it's private equity or whether it's a low to no interest loans. We can go over and build infrastructure projects through mining, through commercial developments, through government contracting, anything that we want to do is wide open. Because again, we're dealing with international banks and international funds and private equity funds that develop in emerging markets. And that's what the majority of the continent is, opportunities to develop third world countries and bring them up to standards for tourism and standards for infrastructure projects that we're accustomed to. And I think that what you're saying, harnessing the black business person and their dollars to do business on the continent, is my mandate. That is the whole purpose of me to promote trade and investment, specifically in Sierra Leone, but really throughout West Africa. So I welcome that. And I challenge us to get behind one another and support that and encourage people to invest on the continent.
Well, Brother Ambassador, we certainly hope that you continue to come on, because we continue to hear this message and to encourage others to join us, especially financially. So again, our mics are open, and after a few brief questions, I'd like to hear from go out to California and hear from Brother Pruitt.
Good evening, everyone. Assalamu alaikum. This is Sister Joyce out of Oklahoma City. And brother, I just want to, just listening to you speak, my imagination was just everywhere you've been. I think I made a like a visual transition there. So I just wanted to congratulate you today for the wonderful life as well as exposure, and we're happy for you to come back to the community to share your knowledge and information with us as we try to find out or figure out how we or what place that we have in this global society. And I can't think of a better place than our own motherland. So with that in mind, brother, now, you know, when you first started talking, you were speaking of how, you know, in terms of community activism or just participating in your community. But now what I, you know, just looking at that little aspect of it, because before we go back global, I would like to know in terms of community patrol. You know, that was a time when, you know, we had the, what they call the Fruit of Islam, who basically patrolled the area. Is there a way? Because, you know, they speak of being able to satisfy this need before you can move on to another need. And security and being safe or feeling safe is one of the basic needs. So, you know, what do we do to get back to community patrols that were in women and seniors and men and women can kind of get back to a normalcy before we can even start thinking about branching out? Brother, we have to work on our minds. And, you know, no one better than a Muslim man here in the United States has a better way of figuring out what's going on in your mind than we do. So if you could explain how we make it get back to, because I tell you, but I need a contact, some contact information as well. So I'll be quiet now.
So my response to that is really organization and community support. You know, over the last maybe 15 years or so, our community has been struggling to identify good leadership and also good organization. And I think collectively we're going to have to come together and support each other in those areas, leaders in industry, leaders in community organization, leaders in safety, just like you're saying. How do we keep our community safe and get the guns off the street and everything else so that our children can learn and go to school and not be in fear? But that's our responsibility. That's not the responsibility of our elected officials. That's not the responsibility of our European brothers and sisters or our Hispanic brothers and sisters. As a community, just like we were taught in the nation, we have to do what we need to do for ourselves. Organize, get into business, educate our own, teach our own, build our own institutions, whether that's schools, hospitals, masjids, et cetera. You know, here in Atlanta, we launched a Halal Meals on Wheels program just to feed our seniors during COVID. We didn't go ask somebody to do that for us. No, my wife and I put up some money. We brought some vehicles. We got a list from the masjid on all the seniors who were in need, and we start feeding our people. That's what we have to do. Is take action and not start complaining or pointing fingers and talking about what the government can and can't do and what others can and can't do. We got to get out here and do it. And then Allah bless us.
Yep.
We were able to raise over $2 million after we started doing our own Halal Meals on Wheels program. And now we just won a contract this year to feed all the seniors in DeKalb County. So our program has grown from just feeding Muslims to now feeding and supporting seniors throughout the whole DeKalb County. In partnership with the DeKalb County government and Meals on Wheels of Atlanta. So now we'll be doing that for the next 3 years. So I appreciate your passion. I feel what you're saying, but it's up to us to solve our own problems.
That's right.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
My mic's open.
I had asked for some contact information.
We'll be getting into that as soon as he finishes. Our mics are open, and our brother, mics are open. We welcome your questions.
Yes, this is Brother Aziz, Brother Bilal, Brother Ambassador Shamsuddin, Assalamu alaikum. Yes, sir. I've heard about doing business with Africa, and I've heard positives and I've heard negatives. And the one question I have to ask you, what is the feeling that you have that in your experience up to this point between the African-American and the African and doing business? Do you find there's a lot of trust there, or do we have to build trust? Because I've heard the stories of people getting taken by business over there and, you know, and losing their money totally. Could you tell me anything about that? Is there a certain amount of trust, or how should business be conducted over there?
Well, first, that's a great question. And I think when we put things into perspective, it'll help you understand it. If we are in America and you want access to the president, or you want access to the governor, or you want some national contracts through the Small Business Administration, or you want to write some grants through the Department of Education, there is a process.
Yeah.
You will take time, money, effort, lobbyists, fundraisers, campaign donations, everything to get that level of access. On the continent, it's the same way. If you want access, there is a undertone that you have to pay to play. In America and any place in the world, there is a budget that you have to allocate for that level of access to do business and trade. Now, in addition to that, you can lose all your money in America, right? And
right.
People on the continent exploit Africans. The Chinese come over there. They pay everybody off. They do what they do, whether it's exploiting natural resources or going after government contracts and building airports and bridges and roads. The Russians are over there. The Europeans are over there and have been over there for years, right? Everybody's on the continent doing business except us. Except us, right? And we should be first in line. So it's not about trust. I think we have to go over there first and get to know each other. Then we can build the trust and then build the business. But we can't operate in a space of fear. And I think the image for us has always been fear. Oh, Boko Haram is going to cut your head off. Or Ebola or E. coli or COVID is going to, you know, or malaria. All the reasons why they don't want us to connect with our brothers and sisters on the continent. Oh, you go to Dubai, have a good time, go to Africa, be careful. We got to change the narrative and the image of us doing business with us. Once we get past that, we can go make some money.
Fantastic. Very good explanation, Brother Ambassador. Very good explanation. I appreciate that. Absolutely. Thank you.
What's important to note, right, is I could very well be the first ever African-American that was appointed by a sitting president of another country. Right now, you have access. You have access to government. You have access to diplomacy. You got access to power. You got access to West Africa. I'm one of only a few blacks who carry the title of ambassador. Ambassador Young, right? Ambassador Wally Chancellor. This is not ceremonial. I'm not a brand ambassador. I have diplomatic credentials. I have dual citizenship. I was appointed a chief. I have immunities and privileges. Like, I cannot be arrested. I cannot be pulled over by the cops. There is no search and seizure. There are benefits that come with being a diplomat that's protected by the Vienna Convention all over the world. We are in a unique position. We, right now, our community, African-Americans, African-American Muslims, to leverage my office, leverage these credentials, and do some real business on the continent. There's not many people you know can pick up the phone and call a president, call the Minister of Finance or the Minister of Mines or the Minister of Tourism and make shit happen. Understand what I'm saying?
That's right.
And we may not have this access in the future. We have it right now, right? Obama was president for 8 years. We had 8 years of access. Now Biden's in, right? I am a special envoy and a diplomat and an ambassador right now. What are we going to do with it? How are we going to mobilize our community and pull our resources together and have impact right now? Not next year, not 5 years from now, not 10 years, right now, next week, what can we do on the continent?
Yes, sir.
Who's going to jump on a plane with me with their resources and go start a business? Who's going to get into mining and go extract some gold and diamonds and platinum and all that? Who's going to do it right now? That's
and I'm
we
so
need.
Glad that
Those
you put that challenge on the table. So glad you put that challenge on the table, brother, because that's what needs to be stated. What are we going to do with that right now?
That's it.
And Sister Ali, and Ambassador Sampson,
yeah.
Like I said, Ambassador, and like I said, I thought about everything you're saying, even your title. I thought about how wonderful for us to have and begin to have these types of connections. So as you can see, what network and getting to know each other and the kind of knowledge that we're getting from our community. So, Brother Ambassador, we look forward to you staying with us, but we look forward to you continuing to come back and work with us because we're certainly willing to work with you. And, of course, Sister Ali, she is one of our directors. So as far as any information to how you can get to the ambassador, we have his personal, and I know how close the ambassador and Sister Ali is. So again, she will be more than happy, and we'll be more than happy to share any information that the ambassador sends us, and we will have it out there to you. That's why I'm telling everyone, it's very important. New Africa Black Belt Wall Street Business Association and get in contact with us so we can share this information with you. NABASSC@gmail.com. Our telephone number is 301-234-9090 or 202-288-5660. Brother Ambassador, was there anything that you wanted to have them to know now? Because we certainly will be continuing to send them information as you send it to us.
Yes, I will drop in a link to the website. You're welcome to get to me through Sister Sajda. That's not a problem. We'll continue to promote our upcoming delegations. Throughout West Africa, we got a trip planned to Ghana, another trip planned to Sierra Leone and Senegal, and we want you all to be engaged. See my office, my title, my credentials as a tool to access additional resources, and those resources are coming from the continent. So I am of service, and I'm at your service, and let's work together in that capacity.
Thanks so much. And,
Thank you so much,
Brother Ambassador. We really appreciate you. Islam Legan, and like I said, please stay on if you got time the rest of the evening.
Yeah.
Because we'll be coming up with our Eastern Standard Time part of the show here in about 10 more minutes. At this point, though, I do want to bring on another person of good interest, very informative information. And Brother Pruitt, are you with us from out of California? Brother Pruitt from out of California, are you with us? My goodness, I thought we had him on. I guess not. Let me see if we can... Let me see. I see what Brother Hood out of California. Now, are you with us? No, I guess not. In that case, we'll just go to our. In that case, we'll just continue our topic. And again, we're talking about the power of the black dollar. I'm sorry. Our speaker from California is not with us. He had some very informative information. But again, we'll be on next Wednesday, and hopefully he'll be with us then. But in that case, now I am going to ask and see if we got Sister Aisha, our director.
Yes, good evening.
Sister Aisha, how are you?
Good evening.
Well, I'm well, thank you. It's so good to hear everyone's voice.
Oh, in that case, listen, I'm not going to waste any time. It's your show now. It's your hour. So welcome to your show.
Thank you very much. I want to say good evening to everyone. Assalamu alaikum. And if Ambassador Shamsuddin is still there, I would like to say good evening to you and give you the greeting. And I am just so impressed with your credentials. And I know that I feel very much, we knew your father and his great work. And I think you and I have met many years ago at a conference. And I want you to know that I too believe that there's a great deal that we can do on the continent of Africa. And having worked on that continent and brought programs and work with the government in both the nonprofit and the for-profit sectors, there's a lot that we can do. And hopefully Africa needs the resources that we as the African American can provide. But however, although Africa has resources, we must remember that Africa want us to bring the resources that this wealthy country has that can benefit them in a way that they will have control over those resources and that those resources will not be used to exploit additional resources from the continent. Thank you so much, and hopefully we at Black Belt Wall Street can be of service to your effort, and we certainly look forward to it. And with your strong constituent base, get them to go to the website, become a member. This is a tremendous effort, and we need the membership, and we need large volume membership. So as we move forward in the international arena, we can take the strength of our constituent base as well to support your constituent base, and we all become one. So I thank you so much.
Alhamdulillah. Thank you for those comments. My pleasure. And wa alaikum assalam. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So last week we started the conversation on redlining, Brother Bilal, and of course we're always concerned about the impact. Can you hear?
Yeah, go right ahead. I'm sorry. Was there a question you had for me?
The question was, we were talking about redlining last week, and we also wanted to have that conversation with you again and talk about the impact of redlining, the impact of climate change on what we are feeling and experiencing with this devastation of redlining. And redlining has become a consequence that we're going to have to deal with as a people. So you were making some great points last week. And if you want to continue directing the focus of that conversation, we're pretty much with you on that.
Redlining, and we talk about the power of the black dollar. You see, redlining was put together by the federal government, our federal government, to where we would never have the topic of knowing anything about the power of our own dollars, because redlining was meant to see to it that large amounts of monies never got to the black communities. That's why you couldn't have equities in your homes, and that's where the advantages of most Caucasians have over African Americans. After the New Deal, when it was put together by after World War II, all the white veterans, including Jews, could have, after the war, all they had to do was sign their name. And they could go into a brand new homes. And some of the home developments, of course, was being created. We know New Rochelle, New York, we used that one because that was the beginning of how successful the Veteran Houses Association was going to be, and it turned out to be because that was the agreement that the federal government made with our returning veterans from the war, that they would become vested with America and grow with America because of their services, all but the black veteran. He was denied participation in the housing program. Therefore, those white veterans who came home from the war and moved into these brand new developments, a year after they moved into these developments, equity grew in their communities. And this is how New Rochelle, and we talked about last week, and Brother Aziz and I both looked it up, and I'll let him explain here in a second the statistics of what New Rochelle looks like today. But again, because of redlining, barriers was put in wherever barriers was put up, where you would have the black communities on one side and the white communities on the other side. And of course, the black communities and the white communities knew their place. They knew where they couldn't go and where they couldn't go, especially back in the early 40s and 50s, right on up until 1965 when we got integration. But redlining was an intent by the federal government and all of the financial institutions in this country, all of our legislators. They all worked together to see to it that the black dollar could not stay in the black communities because, again, they wasn't encouraging any businesses. And that's why you don't see any banks in the black communities, any big brokerage, no kind of financial institutions, no kind of large department stores where you find the black communities, because they did not want to have that large cash flow in the black community. And that's why white folks have such a large advantage over us today, because they were able to use their equities, and they've been using equities of their homes and their businesses for many years, as to where we wasn't able to. So again, that's a history that was started 100 years ago, and it never been taken out of commission. It still goes on, and it's still legislated. And again, unfortunately, our federal government put together that legislation. Brother Aziz, you can tell them now about the statistics of that brand new community that started in New Rochelle, New York, that was started by veterans.
You know, well, yes, Brother Bilal. Well, you know, in New Rochelle, for one thing, the percentage of the black population there is like 20%, the white population 55%. But the difference in the money, that the income is different. Matter of fact, New Rochelle has a long history of discriminating against blacks. And it goes back in, like you say, right after the war. And one of the things about the black population in New Rochelle is that the income, the whites there, a family of four has an income of $106,000 a year, whereas a black has like $50,000. And it's plus New Rochelle was also, to give the true history, the real history of New Rochelle, one of the first free communities, African Americans from slavery communities And this was before the Civil War, Revolutionary War, that the residents of New Rochelle, they fought both the Civil War and the Revolutionary War. But as time went on, New Rochelle City Council, you know, the fact that blacks got, they got run out because of economics and that, and a lot of them weren't able to stay there, and the ones that did, they were relegated down to the poor there, and they were the ones that had established New Rochelle, New York. But, yeah, if you get a chance to history, our listeners, if you get a chance to really look in on that history, like I say, New Rochelle, it was one of the first communities of free blacks that existed before the Revolutionary War, and it was part of the, also was part of the Underground Railroad, and they said it was a black population that was in New Rochelle. Matter of fact, in 1698, and that goes back quite some time ago. So we've been there for a long time, but right now they say only about 18% of the city is black, where at one time it was all black. So if you get a chance to read up on the history of New Rochelle, it has a long black history. Back to it and see how we go ahead on, Brother Lyle.
You know, Brother Aziz, rather than the people's population of the people's and all like so, if you went to New Rochelle today, you'll find it to be one of the richest cities in America. Only folks living in New Rochelle, if you go there today, you'll see basically rich folks. How did they become rich? The veterans who had the equities, and that equity, they started building businesses, and the businesses kept on being. That's the disproportion of the African-American communities and the black and the white communities all over this country. This is the damage of redlining, and that damage is still going on today. So again, yes, we as African Americans, we exist in all kinds of neighborhoods. But when it comes to economical growth or economical opportunities, everything is put together as to where they don't want African Americans to have large sums of money. That's why I came on telling you about the statistics of last year's spending, consumer spending, of $1.6 trillion. And the same projection, African-Americans aren't making these projections. The Caucasians are making these projections. They're receiving the money. And they're projecting this year that they'll get $1.8 trillion. So, again, this is the picture that you will see when it comes to redlining. It was intended to keep monies out of the African American communities. And of course, we know that there's been many, many other examples, such as Black Wall Street and that oil that they took out of the Greenwood District. That oil is still flowing. Nobody stopped that river of oil from flowing. The only thing about that river of oil flowing now, what belongs to the black folks in the Greenwood District, white folks are taking it. Do you know how many trillions of dollars that oil is still making? That's how black belt Wall Street, the business plan that Booker T. Washington put together that had banks before integration all over this country. The best times of America was during the time of segregation. That's when the dollar bill flowed in our community for, I think someone said, 40 months during that time before it would leave our community. But, of course, our situations where large monies are going into the black community, even if it means our destruction, and Black Wall Street shows that destruction, they do not want us to have real economic opportunities in this country. And I can say they because the federal government, our own federal government, those legislators, nobody has never changed that legislation, even as we speak today. So again, Sister Aisha, yeah, redlining is a devastation. And like you said, when it comes to a disaster, it's been a major disaster for us for over 100 years.
Well, you know, it is well known, and it has been stated repeatedly, that redlining is one of the most persistent problems that have affected the minority community, especially low-income minority communities, by causing persistent environmental problems. And one of the senators pledged back in 2019, Senator Warren, to help change that scenario. But however, we didn't see that to take place. And we know that the federal government is complicit in fostering redlining. And for the last 50-some years, we have been saddled with this problem of redlining that affected our economic position. But it also pushed the communities, the low-income African-American communities, into neighborhoods or plots of land where we were mostly impacted by the environmental structures of those of that land and in that area. We know that the National Institute of Environmental Health produced a year-long study just a few days ago, and they commented that the communities that are racially segregated communities, and those are pretty much the red line communities, are severely impacted by PM, particulate matter, in the air. And it's contributing on a level of 2 to 1. In other words, the percentage of particulate matter is twice as high in the African-American low-income communities than in the white communities. And so this is impacting the health of the communities, especially our children and our elderly people. But these are some of the consequences. Every situation as it pertains to climate change is in, every situation is impacting our communities to a greater extent than any of the other communities in America. And we have these historical issues such as redlining, segregation, that foster these intentional, deliberate consequences for our lifestyle. So that it's no accident that the community, that the housing, the property in the African-American communities were so devalued at that particular time. And now, because of gentrification, which is one of the consequences of redlining, the values are increasing. Well, as those values increase, it's causing more homelessness in amongst us, among our people. It's causing more emotional stress. So there's one system perpetuated against the African-American low-income people in this country, one after the other, that to the point where we are always fighting to rise up, always fighting to rise up. And we know that economics, the economic system in this country is a driver for most of the issues that we have to deal with as African-American people. If Ambassador Shamsuddin, are you still on? Are you still online? perhaps he's not. The question that I had for him that I was unable to ask is, we know that Africa, the African continent, contributes only 3% to greenhouse gases, 3%. But however, they are suffering over 35% of the consequences of greenhouse gas. So does that not say that that is in itself part of this whole scheme of eradication of a group of people? It's one situation after the other. We know that climate change is predominantly man-made, and is man-made for a purpose, and that is the purpose of the wealthy. So I would like to hear from someone in the listening audience, how do you foresee the impact of climate change or the relationship of climate change consequences on the lifestyle of the African-American people in this country? Would anyone like to address that?
Our mics are open. We welcome your questions.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Okay, Brother Ozzie, let's just get one in front of you. Go right ahead, sister.
It's Bernice in Delaware.
Yes.
And so often I love to share what I already know answers to, and I guess the answer that I have is one that I'd love to share, especially being a writer. I'm a retired English teacher, one of the members of New Africa Business Association anyway, and so I dearly love the approaches we're using, the steps we're taking, but as you all know, over my many, many times of explaining it, when I already know the end of the book, I don't have to worry about what the conclusion will be. We are living out, and I'm speaking of black people, in the diaspora, that means in the West, including the islands, we're living out a prophecy. And until we understand that we're living out a prophecy, we'll be in a quandary. The prophecy, thousands of years old now, and hundreds, about 130 years old, I guess, here in this diaspora, has already been proclaimed. All we have to do is read that proclamation and understand the beginning from the end. This was all said so many, many centuries ago about what would happen to us as a people and what the ultimate would be as a result of our being in such a state. We're coming out of that state. What you're doing right now is part of bringing us out of that state, but it was to be an experience that we were to have before we reach our heights again, and we are now reaching that height. Your enemy knows that you're reaching that height. They are going to be that much more desperate to keep you down, even to the point of genocide. Even though that's not going to happen, their intent will be for that to be. We have to understand that. But we have what I know and you know is a creator who said, it's not going to happen to my people. They're going to have certain experiences. We know the reasons why we're having those experiences. We turn to the world. The world gave us and is giving us a hard knock for loving the world more than loving what we are supposed to be as a people. When you turn to another lover other than the one who loves you most, you're going to suffer some severe consequences. Thus we have. The book and the plays that I've written, and I'd love to have someone out there help me. I've been reaching out to find a cast for the play, because many times you can put things in a play that would take decades to get out to people, maybe centuries. You can do it in a play in two or three in acts, and they'll understand a lot. In the meantime, though, listening to the things very well said tonight, we know we have redlining. We know we have segregation. We know we have white flight. We know we have gentrification. We know we have the colonizing of the moon so people can run away from the mess they've made. We know the colonizing of Mars because of the mess they've made here. After a while, it's not going to affect just black people. It's going to affect anybody not rich enough to run away from the mess. White flight was running away from the mess. Redlining, running away from what they didn't want in competition. We know all that stuff. However, we have to look at what can we do right here in our own country. And you all mentioned Marlabelle, a country within a country as black Americans. Let's talk about that. Instead of talking about, and I'm not saying instead of, along with talking about dual citizenship, we have $1.8 trillion. We are a country within a country. Let one of our discussions lead us into how can we be our own within our own. Didn't we just say not too long ago that it was Frederick Douglass, was it not, who said you got to do for yourselves? And so I'd like to see us talk more about that. But we already know the end result. We're rising up. When people see you rising up, they're going to become desperate to push you back down again. There's no pushing us down again, but we have to be the ones to push ourselves up. We'll talk some more, but I do want to share some more with them. What I have is that late.
Well,
God bless you.
Well, you know, thank you very much for your comments. And I think that we recognize that we are always rising up and having this dialogue is to make us remember the work that we have to continue to do. And I don't think that there is any objection to the position of that, of course, that we take here, because we are just reminding ourselves and reminding our listeners that we have to work together. And if we don't work together, we cannot be successful. No man is an island. And I think, sister, that's some of the things that you were alluding to. And so if we stay the course and if we work together, we know that one of the issues that we as a people, and I'm talking about America now, America, there's not one person in America who, adult person, who does not realize that our climate is changing. I cannot imagine that there is anyone who does not realize that. However, with that realization, we only have 72% of Americans who are unprepared to deal with the devastation of climate change. So why can't we, with the realization that climate change is taking place, drought, disasters, people are dying, property is floating away, families are being reduced to poverty, to homelessness is increasing, all of these different issues are facing our communities and our neighborhoods, but yet we are not moving towards being prepared for them, for these situations. So anyone, talk about or give us some idea why we as a people are not becoming prepared. Is it because we are afraid to even talk about the issue? Because someone told me that a few weeks ago, that they thought we were just afraid to talk about it. And we know it, but we wish it would go away, so therefore we don't talk about it. But it,
right.
So I invite comments.
Well, sorry, this is Brother Aziz. And I wanted to say that part of the problem is, as we've been taught before, that we still have the residues of slavery, that slave mentality. And with the welfare programs and all that going on, it's been this mindset that someone else is going to take care of that for us. And I think that's one of the main reasons why that our people come up short, like Katrina and other things, as well as still not responding to the programs that's out there, the FEMA programs, as well as your program. They're not responding because they think that when this comes upon them, somehow or another they're going to get help. Wherein I think our leaders in our communities, it's their responsibilities to tell the people that they need to get prepared. If they tell the people that there's ways to go get prepared, people can tell you how to prepare yourself. So I think it's a mindset that we're working with, working to try to change, as well as more community leaders need to be aware of this and then talk it and taking that back into the community and getting some response from them, because we do know that in many of the Caucasian communities, they are getting prepared. But that's just my opinion, Sister Aisha, one of the reasons why the preparation and responses hasn't been coming. But I also wanted to say, in the community that I come from in Alabama, over the years, but lately it's been an increase in immigrants coming into the community and occupying most of the houses, that any empty houses, as well as repairing abandoned ones, getting those, and it's affecting the community because some of them have been they have criminal past and they have committed crimes in the communities and that, and people don't really have any protection around because they all these immigrants, they're coming into the black communities before they put them into any other community. So that's how it's affecting our people, as well as they're getting monies to help these people when the people in our African-American communities could use some help already before these people come. So adding that to what I was saying about the mindset, yes, these people coming into our communities that are immigrants, that are applying for citizenship or whatever, they're coming in there because of the climate change. It's taken away from a lot from our community, splitting up our community, and I think that our leaders just need to address both of those situations.
Well, you know, other day I was informed about a new study, and this particular study, and I have to get the reference to that, the conclusion was that in the African-American community, more elderly African-Americans are becoming homeless through gentrification. Their houses that were devalued during redlining, as a result of redlining, now there are speculators coming into the communities, and they are buying these homes from the elderly who are on fixed income, and many of them are retired teachers, retired professionals, and they're paying off their debt. And after the money is gone, which is not the true value of the house, of course, then these speculators do a little repair and put the houses back on the market at 200 and 300% higher than what they bought the house for. But now we have an elderly population and they have no place to go. So this is an issue for our community leaders to start looking at that situation. We as people, we cannot allow our elders who have worked so hard and many of them educated us to become homeless because of an issue that we have not confronted. And this is certainly one. And hopefully, as I speak to, and thank you, Brother Aziz, for mentioning the community leaders have to start talking about preparedness. So that will help me get a, I will focus on the leaders as well as the broader community, the organizations. So we need the ones who are listening to us on the radio every Wednesday night or sporadically to bring your organizations, put us in contact with your community-based organizations. Let us talk with them. Let us bring them into the circle of training their constituents and getting prepared for natural disaster and climate change that causes the natural disasters. And we, by the grace of God, we're not going to stop talking about climate change and natural disaster until people begin to wake up. And this is what we would like for you to do. If you have an organization out there, send us the email. Put us in touch with the organization. Let us talk to the leaders and let us talk to your people and get people trained so they will have the essential supplies. They will have a plan on what their family is going to do when the disaster strikes their neighborhood. Where are their children? What are their children going to do if their children are stuck in the school? Where do you meet your child if there is a tornado, an earthquake, that or a hurricane? Have you talked to your children about this? That there is a place where we're going to meet if we get separated? Do they know your telephone numbers? The ones who don't have cell phones, do they know your telephone numbers? And some of the young people we are finding out don't even know the address where they live. So we've got to do better, because when that storm strike, it would strike the neighborhood of the wealthy the same as the neighborhood of the poor. But we're the ones, the poor communities are the ones that would suffer the most. So I say
well,
to
Aisha,
the parents, yes.
I know as of May 25th and 22 through July, up through August, and we covered it. It's amazing how the blog radio talk show extensively, as a matter of fact, I have all of the notes on that, extensively covered these things, everything from the family basics in terms of preparation to, let me see, disaster preparations through all of this. There's practically a book that we covered. So what I'd like to know is what you said. Since we already have this information, is there some way we can continue this? Because if we gave it extensively over, well, over 2 months. Sometimes you have to repeat, or at least as you said earlier, find one organization in each state that will repeat what the radio blog show has already extensively given anyway, in addition to the FEMA Family Basic Disaster Supplies booklet. I have it right here before me, where people just keep saying this over and over to people. The few months we did this is not enough. Let's find one organization per state that will have this information, that they will repeat it. We don't eat one meal and expect it to last a lifetime or even a day. Let us keep feeding that plethora of information, because we have it. We've covered it, but covering it and then going on to something else will make it easily forgotten, just like a good meal.
Yes, thank you. Absolutely. Not just one organization. Let us have many organizations. We have,
especially churches, especially
the faith-based groups. Absolutely. And as I get around to these community groups, faith-based groups included, there is a lot of hesitation. And some of the hesitation is that the people are under so much stress, let's not add to their stress. Disaster is becoming a way of life. And you can minimize stress by being informed. And we have seen this. The groups that are informed, they don't worry. The people are saying, I don't have to worry as much. I know what's going to happen to my children. We have it straight now. Even their children are becoming less stressed about climate change and every time they hear about a tornado or a hurricane or bad weather. Their small ones are saying, we're okay, we're okay. And they are telling their other classmates, we're okay in our family. My mom said, we're okay. So this goes beyond just the adults. My greatest concern is the next generation of young people and teenagers. We at home are not informing our children. We're not informing our neighbors. So I agree with you. We need to get the organizations. And one of the efforts that we are putting forth is the training. We want to train the trainers. We need thousands and thousands of people in the neighborhoods throughout America who have the ability to train other groups of people in preparedness. If you are prepared, you can mitigate recovery. You can lessen the burden of recovery. At least you know where you're going and what you can and cannot do. Now, the 72-hour rule that FEMA has put in place, you know, that was based on Katrina. It took the federal government 72 hours to get to the people to rescue them. Do you have enough food and water to last for 72 hours for 3 days? So that 72-hour rule is being practiced by the federal government. And if you are not prepared to take care of yourself and your family for at least 72 hours, you're in trouble. So we have to put the regulations, the codes in practical activity that the family understand. And this is what we would like to do. So if you have those groups out there, put them in touch with us. Put them in touch with Blog Talk Radio, because we're going to stay on it by the grace of God. We're going to stay on this topic until we get a sizable number of people in America prepared. And we like to think that this radio program is the number one catalyst for preparing our people. Because it's one thing to be aware. Aware just simply means that you hear it all the time. But you have to go from awareness to conscious awareness. If you become consciously aware, then you are ready to take action. But just awareness is not going to do it. And we as African-American people know that from the experience of the 60s and 70s and 80s. Everybody was aware of racial discrimination if you had brown skin in this country. But people were not mobilized. And they were not mobilized until they started feeling the pain. Then they became consciously aware. And then it was that point where they started marching, or we started marching in the streets for change. And some suffered physically. But I'm saying we've got to move the people along from awareness to taking action. And that's what having a plan, a disaster plan, is all about.
Okay.
Knowing what you have and ready to move forward. So I would like some comments, but thank you, sister. That was a very good suggestion. And Brother Aziz, thank you for mentioning community leadership.
Yes.
And I like to say that brothers and sisters are looking at my a board and looking at the callers from so many different states. We'd like to hear from you. Any comments, that even if it's no more than introducing yourself or saying what your business is, we know that you can hear us and we can hear you. And we love to hear, have your comments, because we do know that we have listeners from many, many different areas. We welcome you, but most of all, your comments just may help us. So again, our mics are open. Any questions you may have, any comments you'd like to make, or anything that may be concerning you, we welcome your comments. Our mics are open.
You know, there was a, while you all, the audience is trying to get their question together, I want to mention there was a hip-hop caucus that took place at a political forum. And this group in this hip-hop caucus made a comment, these young people, they said that air pollution is an epidemic in minority communities, and that the residents and the, well, they said the people in these communities are literally dying for a breath of fresh air.
Yep.
Now, this is the hip-hop group that made this comment. And I think if we have, yes.
As-salamu alaykum.
Wa alaykum as-salam.
Can you all hear me? This is Suleiman, Imam Suleiman Akbar, calling from Huntsville, Alabama.
Go right ahead.
Been listening to the dialogue and hearing some few things, and would just like to make a couple of comments, if I may.
Yes, sir.
First and foremost being, in order to come out of the current self-destructive conditions that the sisters and you all are talking about, the first and foremost important thing is to start to teach our children how to be vested in the community. Our
mm-hmm.
children are no longer vested in the community or in the family ties that gives the protection to the community. With the social media, people have learned to be distant, to be to hide behind not being present humanly, to hide behind not feeling the actual felt and seen in the actual real-time day-to-day life. This is critical and important to teaching the children. We will not be able to change until we can teach them how to be vested and concerned in the community. What do I mean? Practical example. We see college alumni giving back millions of dollars to high academic institutions in America. We've only had one or two examples from the African American community and that type of money being given. I believe it was Sister Camille Cosby, who gave many, many millions of dollars back to the Alumni Association to ensure that others would be able to be educated. We're no longer vested in the community. We're vested in money. We're vested in material things. And essentially what's happening is our worlds are being physically destroyed. And these sister speaks about a critical and important thing, greenhouse emissions, and what we're doing to our atmosphere. And once upon a time in the Washington, D.C. area, everybody was going green. They were planting gardens on top of their roofs and going green and wanting to remove the carbon emissions from the air and become a positive result. But more money and more programs were thrown at them, and we became more distant. So the family is scattered and destroyed. We have a few people here talking about it, but it starts in our homes with our children. Then we will be able to have generations to better the conditions, to better be in better situations when a natural disaster occurs, preparedness. When I was a kid coming up in the South, we were always taught to have food pantries, to have food prepared for disaster. I grew up in Hurricane Alley, I don't know if you guys know what Hurricane Ali is. You don't know what Hurricane Ali is?
Mississippi, and we know.
Me and my brother, we grew up in Hurricane Ali. My brother's Abdulaziz Saeed on the Blog Talk Radio there. We know about disaster preparedness. But what has happened is for many of us, we leave those conditions. We leave our communities and we go to the big cities and we drive the big cars and we do the fine things and we forget about where we came from. That's why somebody mentioned about people coming in and gentrification. That's why our community, you no longer can find a mom and pop store in the black community. No longer. They're Korean and various other Orientals. However, we need to get back to learning to love our community, to work in our community, and to better our community through educating them from the ground up as children. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Thank you, Brother Akbar. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Excellent comment. And I have to agree with you. Yes, we know where Hurricane Alley. We know that. By the way, one of the things that we try to emphasize is the new language that is on the scene as far as climate change, and the new language that the federal agencies are using breaks the United States down, especially the FEMA language, to 10 regions in the country, and Hurricane Alley is in the southeast region, which is Region 4, and the states that comprise that region, Region 4, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Kentucky, Mississippi, the Carolinas, and Tennessee. And I say that this is important because we're going to have to start recognizing the new language of climate change, and as we move throughout the years. So when money, resources come from FEMA, it's going to come down based on regions. If you do not know that your state is in Region 4, for instance, here, you will overlook that. You will not know that your state agency has funds for disaster relief because you will not know that you are in Region 4, the southeast region. So this is something that we are constantly talking to community individuals, even the community leaders. They don't know the region breakdown. They know what state they live in. But at some point, the emphasis will not be put on the state. That language is kind of moving and just put on the region. So I wanted to make that comment when you missed your Hurricane Alley. Okay.
I think that there is, because we have so many new listeners in so many states, I'm thinking that some of our listeners may not know the benefit of the training and being trained. You mentioned right there you're into the regions. And, of course, we know how big the regions are, but when it comes down to the individual state, and when it comes to FEMA, we know that there is certain there are certain paperwork, certain information, and there is even a certain language that you must know in order to get benefits. In order to even get a recovery or even the disaster itself. But we know that when it comes to our communities getting the benefits that our community deserve, African Americans haven't ever received those benefits. I don't care whether go back to Katrina or what have you, or right on up to today's date. We're not getting those benefits because, again, we as African Americans are not able to communicate with FEMA the way that we should know how to communicate with FEMA. And we know that this is what your training is about. Would you elaborate more on the importance and the benefits of the training?
The training is to take you to the point of being ready to act, to do something about your situation. And so we take you through all of the psychological, social implications of climate. And by the time we finish that, through showing you graphs and consequences, hurricanes, you know, causes, droughts cause fires. And if you're on one side of the country, do not, and there is a wildfire, do not think that you are not going to be affected on the other side of the country, when consequences of a disaster can extend 2,000 miles. We saw that with Ian and Hurricane Etta in the past, all right? So we show you that graphically. So when you hear of a wildfire in California, and if you're in the New England region, in some of the other areas, know for sure that you're going to be impacted in some way, because the distance across the United States is only from the east to the west is a little over 3,000 miles. But a storm, we have history that shows the impact of a storm can travel at least 2,000 miles. Okay, and we go through all of this, and we show you graphically so you can understand. We also inform you of where your regions, what region of the country you live in. And so I was just thinking when you were talking, Brother Bilal, we need to have this on the website, the regions, so people can go to the website and see the region of the country that they live in. So when you hear of funding, you'll know if that funding is coming to the area where you can access some of those funds. And the process of how to access funds, we talk about that. All right?
Go right ahead. I was going to say we will initiate that on the website, and I'll work with you on that.
Okay. So we also, in the planning, in the training, we have what is called My Family Plan. It's a template. Fill in the information. And, of course, we're in compliance with FEMA and the other agents, federal agencies. But we go a little further than they go, because the messaging is one of the biggest handicaps with academia. In academia, the universities are primarily the entities that put together the messaging that you see on the internet. And sometimes that messaging escapes the people. The people don't get it. Sometimes I don't get it, and I'm FEMA certified and used to listening to that kind of language. But we break the messaging down to the people, the practical application of the language. And that's very important. We talk about putting together your plan. We walk you through the process step by step. And by the end of that portion of the training, you have a very good idea. All you'll have to do is spend maybe another 30 minutes or so with your family and fill in some information that you cannot do in the training, because you might not have access to it. But we walk you through it. At least everybody in your household should have a function when it comes to a disaster, and they should know what their function is. And that's all part of planning, right? And, of course, documents and all of those other things. In addition, we go through alerts. It's important that you know the three kinds of alerts, emergency alerts. It's very important because, and I think that at some point we're going to probably have that on the website. I don't want to get into it right now. But it's important that you know those alerts. And, of course, you're going to have them on your phone and access to them on your telephone and on your computer. But it's important to know the difference in the sounds and what you're supposed to do when you hear that particular sound, you know. So then we're going to talk about the supplies, readiness. Readiness is having the supplies that you need. And we have a website, an e-commerce site, which is very competitive with other e-commerce sites, that the benefits, some of the benefits from the e-commerce site comes back to the major organization, Black Belt Wall Street. And at some point, Black Belt Wall Street will help support the groups that are affiliated with it, who are members. So that's why the e-commerce site is being developed, and it will be launched in a matter of days. And, of course, it has all of the great emergency kits and the supplies and the this and that. But we do a little something differently. You need to know, first of all, if you, what area of the country do you live in? Put in your state. You can click on your state, and if you put in New York, we're going to immediately show you the essential kits for hurricane, floods, wildfires, landslides, drought, and tornadoes, because those are the hazards that you're going to have primarily in New York. Then you're going to tell us how many people you have in your family, and you will know exactly what you need to get. So we're doing it a little different. We are speaking the language of the people, and we want you to be prepared. When you get that alert to evacuate, you need to be able to go to your closet, get your emergency kit, put it on your back or roll it to your car, and get out of Dodge. That's what you need to do. You don't need to be thinking about what do I need to take. It would all be, you would have already covered that. And this is what motivates your children. This is what brings families close together, when they feel secure. And these kids are hearing about climate change and disasters in school. Then they come home, and mama and daddy or mama or daddy, there is nothing that has been prepared. They are scared to death. And they have all of this emotion and anxiety, and we can't figure out why. But they are afraid because they are hearing about it every day. So we walk you through all of those aspects that you are not hearing about. You don't get it by going to your internet. It's so much stuff on the internet about preparedness and climate change.
Sister Aisha, we're coming to a close. But okay. We will, of course, as you know, you'll be continuing next week. Brothers and sisters, again, until next week. This is, again, the New Africa Business Association. And we're going to close with, we're going to close at this time. So we look forward to hearing from you next week.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
when he was taken from Africa, brought to America, fighting an arrival, fighting for survival. Said he was a buffalo soldier, dread like a rasta.
Fighting on arrival, fighting for survival.